From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik. It's been a while, so we've got lots to share. Let's get going. On this episode, Maine lobster fishermen have had a great run in recent years, in part because of a technique to mark fertile female lobsters for protection.
So you just grab the lobster, underside of the tail, just like that, and it cuts a V-notch right in the tail. Quick, painless, throw her back in and let her do more of her job.
But a new study found southern New England's lobster industry did not as aggressively embrace those techniques, and it's cost them. Then community health workers visit families in their homes to help figure out why they're getting sick and what services they may need. It took a while for that kind of program in Massachusetts to get its legs.
When I first came on board, you know, we would call a family and they were like, kind of like, no, like, because they don't know who I am, you know, and they don't know what a community health worker is.
And now that some families do know what it is and signed up, the program is running out of money. And it's winter in New England, which means lots of gripes about how everyone drives in the snow. There's a class for that. We visit it.
It's sort of like walking on the ice. You take smaller, little, tiny steps, and you're much more gentle. You don't try to run on the ice.
And we wrap up with a pair of our commentators fighting, like cats and dogs, about, well, cats and dogs. All that's just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, Massachusetts voters legalized recreational marijuana more than a year ago, and starting this summer, retail stores are expected to start selling the drug. Some cities and towns have taken steps to temporarily block pot shops within their borders, and others have banned them altogether, as New England Public Radio's Sean Tian reports.
Almost exactly a year after voters in Massachusetts legalized recreational marijuana, pot sales faced a reckoning in the town of Longmeadow.
The town can impose a ban on recreational marijuana sales because the majority of the voters within the town cast a no vote on the legislative ballot.
At a special town meeting in November, Selectman Richard Foster read the proposed bylaws that would ban the sale of non-medical marijuana. Most of the chairs and bleachers in the high school fieldhouse were empty that night. Fewer than 125 people showed up, and without any discussion, it came to a vote. An overwhelming majority raised their green cards.
The motion passes by declaration, 2/3 majority vote.
And with that, the sale of recreational marijuana was banned in the town of Longmeadow. This means residents can use marijuana, they'll just have to buy it elsewhere. It also means the town can't benefit from the local option sales tax or perks in host community agreements that are negotiated with potential pot shop owners. But that's fine with officials in Longmeadow and a growing number of communities around the state.
The final law that was enacted in July, amending the original law, has in it a provision for local control.
Michael Cutler is an attorney in Northampton who worked on the campaign to pass the initiative that legalized marijuana. He says the revised law sets different ways for communities to ban pot sales, depending on how they voted on the statewide ballot question.
Towns that voted no can impose these bans through select boards or zoning boards. Towns that voted yes can only impose a ban by means of a townwide vote.
That's what happened in Milford. The majority of residents in that town voted for legalization in 2016, but in a referendum vote in September, they opted out.
I'm another one who voted in the statewide referendum to allow recreational sales, but when it came to having sales in Milford at this point in time, I didn't support it.
William Kincaid chairs Milford's Board of Selectmen.
We're dealing with a lot of different challenges right now, and people that were contacting me were like, well, we just don't need to be the guinea pigs for this.
That's a feeling Maureen McPhail can appreciate. She's a children's book author in East Longmeadow. In November, the town council there banned marijuana sales with a zoning amendment.
It's that little instinct inside is the mommy gut feeling. I have two sons, and I think it's just a good idea not to have that out there for them to look at and say, oh, it must be okay.
As of now, there's no official count of how many or which of the state's 351 cities and towns have banned recreational marijuana. The Massachusetts Recreational Consumer Council has been keeping an eye on local bans and estimates the number at between 40 and 50. Kamani Jefferson, the group's president, says in some cases, local officials acted with little notification to residents.
It's being mostly campaigned by prohibitionists or elected officials who aren't a fan of this.
Jefferson thinks marijuana restrictions should be left to state regulators. Jim Borgazzani agrees and says he'd like it to be harder for cities and towns to impose local bans. Borgazzani is the Massachusetts spokesman for the Marijuana Policy Project and was spokesman for the ballot question campaign.
I guess I would be a lot more worried if we had hundreds of communities moving forward with bans and moratorium attempts. We don't. You know, there's a good amount, but it's not to the point that the industry is not going to be able to get started in Massachusetts.
And if recreational marijuana proves to be a positive development, or at least not a negative one, he thinks efforts to ban pot locally will eventually burn out. For New England Public Radio, I'm Sean Tian.
All right, let's take a look now at lobsters. Conservation techniques pioneered by Maine fishermen helped drive a population boom that's led to record landings this century. That's the conclusion of new peer-reviewed research. The paper also finds that lobstermen in southern New England could have used the same techniques to prevent or at least slow the collapse of their fisheries, even in the face of climate change. But they didn't. Maine Public Radio's Fred Bever reports.
Cape Elizabeth lobsterman Kurt Brown's been hauling traps since he was a kid. He says he quickly learned that when he pulled up a female lobster covered in eggs, he was looking at the fishery's future.
And so you get used to seeing lobsters, and then you see a lobster with eggs, and it's a whole new animal. The underside of the tail is just covered with eggs.
Since 1917, Maine lobstermen like Brown have used a technique known as V-notching. When they find an egg-bearing female in their traps, they clip a V into the end of its tail and throw it back. So the next time it turns up in someone's trap, even when it's not showing eggs, the harvester knows it's a fertile female and throws it back. And later, the lobstermen pushed the legislature to impose limits on the size of the lobster they can keep because it's the biggest ones that produce the most eggs.
I use my measure right here, right on the measure. At the end of the measure is a little tool in the shape of a V, so you just grab the lobster, underside of the tail just like that, and it cuts a V-notch right in the tail. Quick, painless, throw her back in and let her do more of her job.
And those fertile females have been doing that job very well off of Maine. Since the 1980s, lobster abundance here has grown by more than 500%, with landings shooting up from fewer than 20 million pounds in 1985 to more than 120 million pounds in 2015, with a value of more than $500 million.
Huge, huge increase in lobsters.
Andrew Pershing is chief scientific officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute in Portland. He's one of nine scientists, including fishery specialists, climate modelers, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who worked on a paper just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It documents how harvester practices and other factors have contributed to the Maine lobster fishery's success. Climate change, he says, has been the most important variable. The Gulf of Maine's waters have been warming faster than any other major water body in the world. Off the coast of Maine, that's actually been a boon for lobster, which reproduce most prolifically in water that's a bit warmer than the Gulf was until just recently.
And because we, since about 1999, have been at really optimal temperatures for lobster, it's been about 50% that, and then 50% the management that we have here in Maine. And they really are almost co-equal in the model.
In other words, lobster population growth was twice what it would have been without Maine lobstermen's conservation practices. There are other synergies at work, Pershing says. The warming-driven collapse of the cod fishery, for one, which took one of the lobster's top predators out of the equation. But the scientists bore down on management techniques thanks to a difference in regulation between the Maine lobster fishery and the fisheries to its south. Simply put, V-notching and size limit regulations were much weaker in southern New England, Pershing says. So when water temperatures tipped above optimal levels in southern New England early this century, fisheries there weren't as resilient as they could have been, and they collapsed.
In southern New England, if they had managed the fishery the way Maine did, they would still have a fishery. It would be smaller than the fishery that they had in the 1990s, but they would still have a more productive fishery for sure.
In the field of fisheries management, Maine's story is unusual, in which rather than quotas being dictated from above, the call for specific regulations was led by harvesters. Patrice McCarran, executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, says that dynamic should help Maine's lobster fishery to persist, even if warming continues.
And that's the really, really nice, healthy thing that's going on in 2017, 2018 that didn't happen earlier in the 80s and 90s, is that the scientists do talk to industry. They do listen to industry, and we actually see response, which is really unimaginable.
There are signs that in parts of the Maine fishery, the boom may be over, with the temperature sweet spot for lobster reproduction moving north and east into Canada. Recent data and the new model are predicting that, but scientist Andrew Pershing says that in a warming world, protecting those big egg bearers will significantly temper decline here. Lobstermen, he says, have shown that by committing to smart management, to some degree, they can make their own luck. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fred Bever in Portland, Maine.
Now to a wellness program in Massachusetts that links together community resources to help people improve their health. It took a few years to get rolling and will have to end soon without new funding. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown reports.
The awkwardly titled Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund was set up in 2012 as part of a Massachusetts law to reduce healthcare costs. The idea was make it easy for the medical, school, and fitness worlds to communicate with each other. That way, when doctors notice a chronic problem like asthma or heart disease, they can trigger a home visit by a community health worker, or someone from the YMCA will call a family to offer classes. Pediatrician Vinnie Biggs is involved with the Holyoke program, one of 9 locations around the state.
It gives us the ability to support our patients much more efficiently.
Before this program, Biggs says, he might identify a problem like asthma and urge patients to go home and look for the cause.
I could write a letter for the family so they could go to the landlord and say, you know, please remove the carpets because we think that's a trigger for the patient. But that puts the onus completely on the family to have to do that.
Whereas community health workers like Aldenis Garcia can be more proactive.
Basically, I go look under the sink, if there's any dripping water, you know, open up the shower with their permission to see if there's any mold, any mildew. We look for any you know, mice droppings.
And once they find a problem, the health worker will contact the landlord directly.
Usually the landlords will come out and, you know, take care of it.
What's your name?
David.
And you're here for asthma, huh?
A 4-year-old boy in an exam room at the Holyoke Health Center distracts himself with a Spider-Man video game. His mom, Vionnet, who asked to keep their last name private, is scheduling a home visit. She's eager to find out why her son's asthma has gotten so bad.
If I have something around the house that's causing it, I want to know so I could help him with that.
She's already cleaned the curtains and removed the rugs.
But it's not the rugs. It has to be something else.
She says her son was first hospitalized for asthma 2 years ago, but no one told her about the community wellness program until now.
If I would have knew a long time ago, I would have had the help.
Although the program began 5 years ago, Garcia, the community health worker, says sign-up has been slow.
When I first came on board, you know, we would call a family and they were like, kind of like, no, like, because they don't know who I am, you know, and they don't know what a community health worker is.
And some were suspicious they'd have to pay for the services. Now Garcia says he works with about 30 families in Holyoke. A state report found the program improved people's health and saved money. But it's not clear how long it will go on. It was funded by a fee on insurance companies and large hospitals. That ended last July, in part due to opposition from insurers, says State Representative Aaron Vega.
At certain points, industries like insurance are going to be your partners, and at certain points, they're not going to be your partners.
Vega says he tried to get legislators to re-up the program last summer, but they couldn't agree how to pay for it.
The program's definitely in a dire strait right now.
One possibility in the next state budget is a new tax on flavored cigars. No one is crazy about this funding method. There's the irony of selling tobacco products to fund a health program. And Vega says it's not clear how much revenue will come from such a niche market. But he says it could serve as a budget placeholder until a better option comes along.
The policies of it is to keep the idea at the forefront.
A state spokesperson did not respond to questions on whether the Massachusetts Health Department has advocated for the Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund. In Holyoke, providers say they'll stretch the funding through June. If the program has to shut down, even temporarily, health workers like Garcia worry it will be hard to get it rolling again, especially when it comes to building relationships with families.
You have something there, and then all of a sudden you're just going to take it away. They're going to be like, well, I'm not going to trust them again, or they're not going to go with it.
For now, community health workers are still making appointments, and promoting better habits and conditions where they can.
And I see you the 12th. If not, just call me and let me know, okay?
Gracias. Okay, thank you.
For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
Already this winter, you've probably said to yourself, it's New England, why can't anyone drive in the snow? In New Hampshire, reporter Chris Jensen visited a school that teaches the lost art of winter driving.
When rally driver Tim O'Neill was a teenager, trying to learn how to drive on the snow and ice-covered roads in the North Country, it was, well, a hit-or-miss situation.
I spent an incredible amount of time learning the old way, which is hitting things.
Now, after decades of rally racing, O'Neill runs a 600-acre driving school in Dalton, New Hampshire, that focuses on rally driving. But it also includes a one-day winter driving course. And on a Saturday in January, about a dozen folks have paid the $499 tuition. They're driving on a huge open area covered in ice and snow and surrounded by snowbanks. Instructor Chris Comar is riding with 16-year-old Brenna Morgan. At 30 miles per hour, Comar plans to tell her to brake and swerve around a make-believe moose. At the last moment, he'll tell her whether to go left or right.
What was that
don't
about?
Don't like this.
Okay, go, go, go. That's fast enough. Stop. Go right. Turn back. Countersteer, a little bit of gas. Good. Right? So it was pretty responsive, right?
It's hard to let go of a teenager and just let them be on these roads.
That's Francine Morgan, Brenna's mom.
She's a new driver, and, you know, that worries me. And I want to make sure that she has all the tools in the toolbox to keep herself safe.
Chief Instructor Travis Hansen says his goal is to make sure people stay out of trouble. The class starts with the right tires.
We'd say that an all-season tire sucks in all seasons, right?
But the focus is being smooth with the steering, gas, and brakes. Tires have far less grip on snow than dry pavement, and accelerating or braking too hard reduces the grip further. It can cause the car to slide. Here's how rally school owner Tim O'Neill describes it.
It's sort of like walking on the ice. You take smaller little tiny steps and you're much more gentle. You don't try to run on the ice.
Students also learn about using the brakes and the gas to shift the weight of the vehicle to the front or the rear tires to get grip where it's most needed. And when the car starts sliding, they're told to look where they want to go, not at what they're afraid of hitting. By mid-afternoon, most of the students are confidently handling skids. Brenna was nervous at the start of the class. She'd only driven on snow twice, but she's had a good day.
I feel like I could keep myself safe if there were adverse conditions, which is really comforting.
But it's been a tough day for high school student Wade Atkinson. Wade's Acura has all-season tires. There's very little grip.
Go right, turn back, countersteer a little bit this way, a little bit of gas. Stop, they're done. They're done. Oh. Yep, you came in a little bit fast.
Yeah.
All right, let's see if she'll come out of here.
Oh, losing control of your car, yeah. It's so scary. You feel completely helpless and you're worried you're gonna break something, and that's probably the largest like thing that really, really like hurts. Is being afraid that you are going to break something on the car.
After all that, Wade's conclusion is that he really, really wants snow tires. For the New England News Collaborative, this is Chris Jensen.
A little over a year ago, commentator Robert Chipkin was on New England Public Radio talking about research showing dogs love their owners more than cats. He did not pretend to hide his bias. And now Chipkin's back with, he says, new and not-so-revolutionary research findings.
Lately, I've noticed a growing cottage industry. Human scientists are making a pretty good living spending years doing experiments the results of which any dog could have predicted if only someone had asked. This just in, dogs are smarter than cats. Researchers from Vanderbilt University examined the brains of a variety of cats, dogs, ferrets, mongooses, or is that mongeese, raccoons, hyenas, lions, and more. I shudder to think how. They found that A, dogs in general are smarter than cats in general, and B, in particular, golden retrievers are smarter than African lions, brown bears, and striped hyenas. Full disclosure, a golden retriever is top dog in my house. The lead scientist, who burnished her impressive academic credentials by admitting she is an avowed dog lover, backed up her findings by objectively reporting that dogs have 530 million neurons in the cerebral cortex of their brains, while cats have only half that amount. Neurons, for the striped hyenas in the crowd, are the information processing units in the brain, and the cerebral cortex is the part of the brain that can combine information from different sources and create new associations, recognize patterns, make decisions to act differently based on past experience, and start making predictions for the future, which means, and remember, this is the Vanderbilt researcher talking, so cat lovers can send their letters to her, dogs can be expected to be capable of more complex and flexible behavior, such as guard work, movie acting, first responding and assisting the blind, while cats can be counted on to, well, use a litter box. Now, cat lovers will undoubtedly say that cats could do any of those things if they so desire, but just don't want to give their human masters the satisfaction, which may be true, but which begs the question. I leave to those cat lovers to ponder why their cats consider delivering satisfaction to their humans a bad thing. By way of reference, the researcher did point out that humans possess roughly 16 billion cortical neurons, so that neither canines nor felines are in any danger of taking over governance of the planet anytime soon. But considering the mess we humans have been making of things lately, frankly, if given a choice, I'm inclined to vote for the striped hyena.
Robert Chipkin is a Springfield writer who loves to malign cats. Well, we invited cat lovers to respond, and writer Naomi Shulman jumped at the chance.
An open letter to Robert Chipkin, researchers at Vanderbilt University, and all dog triumphalists ever for the end of time. Your dog may be smarter than my cat. This is not a great feat. My cat's brain is about the size of a walnut. Crows are smarter than my cat. Dolphins are smarter than my cat. You are smarter than my cat, too, as a human being, I assume. I'm willing to go with that. Your dog may be more trainable than my cat. In fact, I'm sure he is. And birds are more capable of flying than my cat. And snakes are more slithery than my cat. And fish are better at breathing underwater than my cat. My cattily made point, if you haven't already gotten it, is that comparing your dog to my cat is like comparing the proverbial apples to oranges. They're different species, and they have different qualities. I don't want or need my cat to behave like a dog, so stop measuring cats by doggy yardsticks. Will there ever be seeing-eye cats? Actually, I Googled it, and there is at least one seeing-eye cat, but I'd turn to a dog for that job, as not all animals are meant to be aid workers. Not all human beings are, either. Some of us are great ER docs. Others of us are born to be solitary, brooding poets. You wouldn't disparage Emily Dickinson because she wasn't yelling out stat in a hospital ward, right? That's because she's a poet, not an ER doc. My cat is a cat. She behaves like a cat, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some of us are introverts, some of us extroverts. Some of us favor green, some red. Would all you red-favoring extroverted dog lovers just let us green-inclined introverted cat people be? Back to Robert Chipkin, who snidely asked cat lovers to explain why cats consider delivering satisfaction to their humans to be a bad thing. Dude, they do deliver satisfaction to their humans. So much more than many dogs, in my experience, not to mention humans. You just don't see it because you're not looking for the kind of satisfaction they deliver. That cats don't deliver it the same way dogs do doesn't make them any lesser. It just makes them less doggy. It's so like a dog to come bursting into the room, panting, and assume that the standard by which you operate is everyone else's standard, too. Take a seat, my friend, and consider that not everyone is coming at this from the same place, okay? Sit. Stay.
Naomi Shulman is a writer and cat lover. She lives in Northampton, Massachusetts. That's all I have for today, but remember, this is only a small share of the stories produced by the news teams at New England Public Radio and the 8 stations that make up the New England News Collaborative. Find much more at NEPR.net. New England Public Radio is a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and all the podcasts at NEPR.net. That includes The Shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review, when host Adam Frenier chats with a panel of journalists about the big regional news stories. You can check it out at NEPR.net/podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.